welcome everyone to episode 256 of the Metabolist 2 podcast, featuring myself, Ben.
And I am David, and this episode of the Metabolist 2, we are going to continue a look at Ian Martyr's career with Doctor Who, and we're going to tackle two stories in this pod, and they are...
The Ark in Space.
And the Santarin Experiment, back-to-back.
The back-to-back, same director, almost like a six-parter in some ways.
Yeah, six-parter. Well, all the studio stuff was in the Ark, and all the location stuff was on...
Dartmoor.
Was in the Santarin Experiment.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, effectively a six-parter.
Yeah, they cross-referenced each other enough for it to be a little bit like a six-parter.
Mm-hmm. You couldn't have the Santarin Experiment without the Ark in Space.
No, you couldn't. And I think if they were around the other way, people really would be, you know, it would be like a Seeds of Doom, which is effectively, you know, a two-parter and then a four-parter bolted together.
Yeah.
In a perfectly acceptable manner, but still, that's the way they kind of operate. You can't have one without the other. They go together like a horse and carriage.
Or two crinoid pods.
Two crinoid pods. They travel together like policemen. I believe is the appropriate phrase.
So I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that the Ark in Space is a pretty good Harry Sullivan story. He gets a lot of dialogue. He's mixed up in it quite a bit. And for... being kind of the foil for the Doctor, he does a pretty good job.
Yeah, I think so too. He gets to do doctoring stuff, which he doesn't do very often. And in fact, as is so often the case, the fact that he's an actual doctor sort of melts away relatively quickly. But in this story, he gets to do some medical things. He recognizes when people talk about parts of the body, which the names for haven't changed in 3,000, 4,000 years, which is excellent. He allows Sarah to be, because he's distracting the doctor with kind of lowering laser bolt defense systems. So Sarah gets all set into suspended animation, which, you know, wouldn't have happened if the doctor and Sarah had just been taking care of each other, which, you know, then gets some jeopardy in the suspended animation chamber, blah, blah, blah. And he's, you know, he's agreeably... 1970s male chauvinist piggery, I think, is on show, which of course was very much de rigueur at the time. When he talks about the Earth, not the Earth president, is it? It's the someone, someone of the fair sex,
yes,
being in charge of Earth.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, he has plenty to do. I mean, he's in charge of the first cliffhanger.
He is indeed. So it's. Yeah. It's a good outing for Harry Sullivan, and I'm wondering if it's not the best for him, actually. Because Robot, he was sort of the forgotten man, but he has almost double the amount of lines compared to Sarah in the story.
Oh, you did a line count?
Yeah, I did. Let's see. The Doctor came in at 363 lines.
Okay.
Harry came in at 255, and Sarah had 126.
Okay.
With Sarah being comatose or in suspended animation, that does cut down on the number of lines you're going to recite.
Exactly. I mean, she's there, but she's definitely not talking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think they do a lot with his character development, too, because, like you say, he's able to work as a doctor. When Sarah passes out, he's first on the scene to diagnose her that she's lack of oxygen, bit of brandy, and then working along with Vyra. He's actually taking over once Vyra is in command.
Yeah, he's taking over the revivification, if that's the right word, of the Earth population people.
And Bob Holmes also works in a bit of the naval nautical lingo for him. You know, he mentions Pompey Barracks, where he doesn't like sliding doors. You know, the doctor's a right boffin. Everything's ship shape. Gremlins get into everything. First law of the sea. All of that kind of ties in. And I think it builds upon the character that Ian was playing in the Robot. It just further develops him and take him out of the naval uniform, and you have him kind of in a sports coat and, you know, the blazer kind of look. He just kind of fits in nicely, and it's sort of like Die Hard the movie, where he's walking around in his socks for the four episodes.
Yeah, I'd forgotten about that. Yeah, It's one of the... I was remember thinking to myself, yeah, does anything happen with that? And sadly, it doesn't.
No.
Which is a shame because, you know, one could have imagined exactly a diehard scenario of some kind with, I don't know, broken glass on the floor or whatever, or bits of spiky bits of Wirren casing that you would have to... Or, actually, this is one thing that I was thinking about it when I watched it again recently for this, is there should have been more slime. It should have been slimier. There should have been more goop. Should have been more Swarfiga daubed over the bubble wrap. And Harry could have stepped in it in his stocking feet, and it would have been, ew, disgusting.
Yeah, there wasn't... The thing with the slime, it's sort of like no one notices the slime coming out of the little enclosures, the alcoves for the people, until the doctor points it out. And it seems like it'd be pretty darn obvious that this is slime. And that's, I don't know if that they didn't think of that in the rehearsal, or of course it didn't exist then, but it just seemed like kind of an oversight that you wouldn't notice the slime. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there you go. I mean, you know, I think. No harm done there. I mean, I did like, as you're picking up on your point, I did like all the nautical bits. You know, he's wearing a nautical blazer with his, you know, shiny gold buttons in a beautiful, you know, navy blue. So he definitely looks the part. He's got his little cravat on, which makes him look posh and cool. The nautical stuff is good. You know, he was in Portsmouth, where obviously he's one of the naval base for Great Britain. That's the reference to Pompey, obviously. He's good.
Just all around bloke with cricketing and, like you said,
he's got his cricket ball.
Yeah,
or cricket skills. That's a difficult throw. I'm watching it. They were hiding under the table. It's like
bad angle.
Yeah, you're not going to make that, mate. Because it's like a tight underarm throw that actually isn't going to do any good at all. Still, I mean, you know, it did keep on establishing how deadly the laser bolts were that were coming from the ceiling.
And the downsides with the characterization, he does touch things that he shouldn't do, and that leads to them going 3,000 or 30,000 years in the future, whenever Nerva Beacon is. And it also is one thing that opens up the sliding door that traps Sarah.
Yeah, shades of Donna Noble there, I think.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
Of that companion vein.
Yeah. Yeah. Or what's her name? The new one, Millie. Who's the one who spills the coffee over the console? That's Millie thingy, right?
Sure.
Sure, yeah, whatever, mate. Yes, yeah, it's them.
Millie Gibson.
No, it's Donna who spills the coffee on the console, and then they go into the Wild Blue Yonder.
Oh, Wild Blue Yonder, yeah.
Because, okay. I mean, as I think we know, RTD is very, very fond of this episode. Well, as is everybody, because it's really good.
As in Stephen Moffat, I believe, too.
Yeah, it's a pretty much faultless story, in fact, to be honest. Being a Doctor Who fan, I, you know, the whole bubble wrap thing is like, I know it's bubble wrap and I don't care. So that's all fine with me. The Wirren are creepy and evil and horrible, but they're also sympathetic because, you know, decolonization, etc. Like, we wrecked their planet, so serve us right. But I mean, you know, and then they nobly sort of kill themselves at the end.
Well, that was Noah's
influence. Exactly. Yeah.
The underlying theme, I think, is the resilience of humanity versus adversity.
Yeah, the persistence of the human within the machine or within the alien or within the time. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, knowing of the big cut where Noah asks Vyra to kill him when she and the doctor go try to track him down, that scene was very noticeably clipped.
Yeah.
You can tell why Kenton Moore was upset that was removed from the story, because it is, I think, kind of awkward how that scene, just 2 seconds or 3 seconds of
just cuts out.
Dialogue, just goes for him dropping the pistol at Vyra's feet and shutting the door.
Yeah, though interestingly, of course, for me, really, this story is part of my reading of Doctor Who, of Target novelizations before there were, you know, I saw it on the TV once.
Right.
And then I never saw it again until it was available on VHS. And in between those two dates, I was reading it as in a book. And of course, it's in the book. So for me, that scene, it plays in my head. You know, it lives rent-free for me. So the actual cut is, it's jarring, but my kind of brain canon says, oh, I must have just looked away then and missed it.
Yeah, well, that's nice to have that kind of restorative memory in place.
Yeah, yeah, and that footage doesn't exist anywhere, does it? It's literal cut and thrown away.
No, otherwise it would have been on the DVD.
Oh, that's true. Yeah,
maybe they found it, but it wasn't on the Blu-ray either. So I think that's totally
that's a shame.
Lost to time, lost on the cutting room floor.
Yeah, and I guess it's tape, so yeah, of course it's not even cutting room, is it? It's like, you know, just not on it anymore. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not like it's a Australian censor clip that can be restored. It is gone.
But I mean, there is a lot of both of these stories have a lot of they're quite hard hitting in terms of their themes and in the way that things are realized, and actually the kind of grimness of both of these stories, and they are both pretty grim. One is grim under the bright lights of a space station, and the other is grim under the gloomy, rainy skies of Dartmoor. Harry's actually one of the lighter features.
Yeah.
You know, he kind of leavens the thing a little bit. Otherwise, it really would be a little not... I mean, I wouldn't mind if it was a horrific slog through things that are just really unpleasant. But, you know, Harry is a... As I said, he's a kind of a leavening, pleasant, human, relatable, I guess. I mean, you know, he's not particularly relatable by class, but certainly relatable in terms of a recognizable kind of British action hero, like, as you keep on saying, kind of Bulldog Drummond / Biggles.
Yeah, but more of a upstanding type character, more of a role model type character, and someone for young people to emulate. Because like when Noah is cracking up and threatening to kill the doctor and Harry and stuff, and Harry's going like, "You'd shoot, wouldn't you?" And kind of as an aside to the doctor, "Nice chap." And it's that sort of, I think Harry's kind of a moral center to this story in some ways. If Sarah's more of the true companion, Harry's role in this is more human goodness, or just kind of a sound, solid morality.
Yeah, it's a sound, solid chap.
Yes. Yeah.
He's sound, he's solid. He's
not a regressive.
He's on good form all the way through. Really doesn't get shaken by a huge amount, apart from, you know, injustice and meanness. And you really, as you say, I mean, you really relate to him. You really like him. And as I often do, you know, I rewind myself back to my childhood with these shows. The falling into a pit and being Harry and having to be rescued, that was a game that I played on. I can remember playing at least once. And if I can remember playing it once, I must have played it 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 times.
Right.
You know, there's always things you can roll down a hill and go like, ah, rescue me. And actually, funny thing about that, it was funny to see Sarah fall over in some heather. It was reminding me of the slight incline of reasonable displeasure, or whatever the incline is in Five Doctors, that she sort of gently rolls down by mistake.
When compared to the Ark in Space, the Santarin experiment isn't quite as good of a story for Harry for many reasons. Mostly, he spends a lot of time just off on his own, so there's not a lot of room for dialogue for him. And he's the one that falls in a trap. Of course, Tom also falls in the trap later, too. So in that regard, Sarah is the cautious one and doesn't wind up in the sewer pit. The biggest disappointment, I think, for me in this story is Harry Sullivan was supposed to be the man of action when he was cast. That was what they were looking for. If they would have hired an actor who was on the older side to play the doctor.
Right.
In this case, we do have, you know, a 40-year-old doctor who can do his own action scenes, unless he has a broken collarbone.
Yes, he's cracked his collarbone, indeed, yep.
At that point, I think it would have been better to have reworked it anyways, because Harry's carrying around this big club of a stick.
Huge, great big stick.
And him, the doctor, saying, "You have to wear out Steyr." I could have seen Harry entirely call him out. You probably would have changed the dialogue, but I think it makes far more sense to have the doctor go into the Santarin ship with the Sonic and take the things out rather than Harry. And I kind of think that was a missed opportunity that could have been a blessing with Tom cracking his collarbone than the other way around. But of course, it wasn't meant to be.
Yeah. I mean, he's, you know, he does give... another thought about Ark. I mean, his presence allows Sarah to be more directly involved in stuff that's going on. And actually, I feel that a little bit with Experiment as well, is that he's there kind of doing more sort of companion-y things, possibly, which allows Sarah to get captured and tortured, which again, you know, allows Harry to swing in and, like, be appalled at someone else being captured and tortured, but this time someone that he knows quite well, which plays to his good side.
And he does get to exercise his medical knowledge a bit when he encounters the Galsec explorer, whatever, being deprived of water.
Yeah.
Who's, and he does try to help him, but there's not much he can do because I guess he's almost too far gone.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
he's,
yeah,
of course, tied up.
The way that, you know, he feeds him gently with water, which through reading thriller novels and watching movies, I understand that's the kind of thing you're supposed to do. It may not be, but anyway, that's the thing that they do on shows like this in a medical way. But yeah, you know, and I would have liked to have seen more doctoring from him, because, you know, obviously these Galsec colonists are being quite seriously abused by the field major in his horrible experiments. And you know, there could have been some more chance for Harry to show his medical expertise there, but
yeah,
was not to be. I really have a lot of time for the Sontaran experiment. Yes, I mean, I agree that there could have been the way everything was passed out in terms of action could have been more effective in terms of the characters that we've established. But it is such a great shorthanded, grim tale, which sets up a lot of stuff for the Sontarans going forward. I mean, clones for a start,
right?
And it's all outside broadcast, obviously, as we know as fans. Which was, you know, big innovation for the time. Kevin Lindsay skipping over those rocks in a Sontaran costume.
Is impressive.
Hats off to you.
Especially if his heart.
Yeah, exactly. Potato-shaped helmets are being doffed in your direction, sir, because really I would not have dared to do any of that that he was doing. I mean, he's a small chap, I guess, so maybe he's...
But in three stories, we have a costume character doing pretty remarkable maneuvers, with Kilgariff in a robot with that huge robot costume, and now Kevin Lindsay in the Sontaran experiment.
It was reminding me of my admiration for Kilgariff, who's obviously a giant of a man, you know, dressed all in sharp metal, which would have done him quite a lot of damage if he'd fallen over. Again, as opposed to Lindsay, who is, I mean, you know, Kilgariff was going down steps and stuff,
right,
but Lindsay was dancing down rocks.
Right.
You know, I'm surprised it was Tom who cracked his collarbone, not Kevin Lindsay by falling over. But, you know, I guess if your job is to be dressed up as a monster as your acting job, maybe you get used to being behind the mask and being able to deal with those kind of difficulties. But yeah, you know, it's wet, it's slippery. Everyone's covered in mud by midway through the second episode. I think it's dried off a bit by we get to the climactic fight. But, you know, certainly it looks very muddy and slippery and difficult.
Aside from Sarah, everyone else, the Galsec colonist, the doctor, and Harry are all kind of mud splattered. The doctor and Harry from falling into the pit. But
right.
It is gritty in a good way, I think.
Yeah, yeah. It was smart of Sarah to wear the oilskins, to be honest.
She's a smart woman.
She is the smart woman. I actually, it's funny, because I obviously have watched Pyramids of Mars quite recently. I noticed that bit of business that she does, where she pulls something down over her face. When she's trying to attract the doctor's attention, or is, you know, not teasing the doctor.
Right.
So because she pulls a hat down over her eyes, and of course in Pyramids of Mars she wraps the kind of a Victorian wrap around her face, which I think that's kind of a nice bit of Liz Sladen business.
Yeah,
which I noticed and had not noticed before. But yes, no, it is nasty, brutish, and short. It's, you know, as a story, it's two episodes, and it's grim. Everyone's dirty. The Galsec columnists, particularly, you know, been through the ringer. We've got burn wounds being displayed, and people being starved to death, and people being off screen, I guess, but, you know, people being drowned. I wonder where Steyr drowned them, actually. Anyway, there's probably a special pool somewhere. And, you know, and then the whole having to hold something above someone and not kill them thing. Yeah, I mean, you know, it really sets up the Sontarans very nicely as not just, as not really kind of honorable warriors as they see themselves, but a bunch of sadists.
They are.
Really, really nasty pieces of work.
And the high body count, too. We do have only two survivors out of that whole Galsec crew at the end.
Nine-man crew. Yep. Seven bit the dust.
Yeah. Yeah. And we have the whole bit of the cuckoo in the nest with the traitor.
Always got to be a traitor. I mean, it's interesting why his mates didn't say, like, what's that on your chest?
Yeah.
It was right there. But anyway.
It's a signature of rank.
Exactly. But it is. It's I often do this preface, but, you know, it's always worth repeating interesting thoughts that I have. I think we may have said this when we covered this story many episodes ago. But it always seems to me how unnecessary these experiments are, which, you know, you could see as a deficiency in plot. But to me, as a fan, who obviously always likes to see the good side of any Doctor Who story, it establishes the fact that these experiments are pretty much unnecessary. And mm-hmm. the Sontarans are really enjoying doing them.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, Star is having an excellent time torturing people to death. And his boss is, like, also, like, seems to think it's a lot of fun.
Or necessary, at least.
Yeah, it's really the kind of lack of envelope around the necessity of the experiments really works for me as establishing these creatures as very, very nasty.
Yeah.
Which is a shame in some ways, the way that they were then revived in the new series, where they become a lot more of kind of, you know, figures of fun than figures of fear.
Mm-hmm.
Apart from the one where they're in the Crimea.
Yeah.
Which was one of the few episodes in The Flux that I enjoyed, and I thought they were really put back in their place as kind of nasty pieces of work in that episode.
Yeah, the Sontarans were set up to be one joke.
Yeah, they were a joke monster.
Basically, that their heads were shaped the same as a helmet.
Yeah.
Yeah, but beyond that, they were, like you said, nasty Brutus in short. You know, that going for that phrase.
Yeah.
Back to Ian in the Sontaran experiment. He does a little bit of nice mime work when he encounters the force field in front of Sarah.
I was noticing that as well. Yeah, I mean, it was reminding me of pyramids,
mm-hmm.
where obviously everybody has to mime not being able to get through something mm-hmm. that's invisible. And I think it's probably a key skill of an actor who's going to be in Doctor Who, is you've got to be able to mime stuff pretty well. I was thinking about Sarah having to pretend, well, Liz Sladen, having to pretend to be scared while she was being tortured by mm-hmm. being scared of things. And, you know, obviously that's something that, I guess, if you're auditioned to be a Doctor Who lady companion, you have to pretend to be scared of things.
Yeah.
I'm wondering whether, you know, when they auditioned Ian Martyr, he had to pretend that he was trapped in an invisible box.
I wonder, for the miming, if that was something that came naturally or something that he practiced on when he was in Bristol Old Vic, or is that something he did on stage when as a student at Oxford, or where that came in? Because he does a pretty good job with it, I felt.
Yeah, well, I mean, as we've discovered, as we've established with Ian, he's not a trained actor. He is what you would call an English major, and then... And then he gets a job at a theater. You know, he's mm-hmm. literally, he did not go to acting school. He did.
Right.
And, you know, I also did not go to acting school, but I'm going to say that one of the classes you have to take in acting school is mime. I'm pretty sure that's one of the skills that they make you acquire in acting school.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Ian didn't have access to any of that, but his miming is excellent. There's a force field right there. He can't get to Sarah. It's really upsetting him.
The thing that I like about Ian Martyr's portrayal of Harry is just how he makes it seem so effortless. He definitely is acting a character, but he embodies that character, and I think he's very believable in as Harry Sullivan. I don't think he's pretending, so to speak, like you get with some actors.
Right.
I feel like he really is Harry.
Right, right. And I think it's interesting, you know, sadly, as we've discovered in doing the research for this series, you know, he didn't get to do as much acting as he might have wanted to, certainly on screen. So acting that mm-hmm. we can see now.
Right.
Obviously, one can't speak for stuff he was doing in theater. But looking at the relatively few roles that he had for TV, you know, he's playing a QC, he's playing a, you know, surgeon commander in the British Navy, he's playing at least two police officers.
Yeah.
Typecast is the wrong word for someone who wasn't in that much stuff.
Right.
But he does do a very good, decent, upper-middle-class bloke,
mm-hmm.
which is what all those people are. And whether that was something he picked up at college or, you know, whether he himself was, well, he's certainly middle class. I wouldn't say he's upper middle class. You know, or whether that's something that, you know, he got from his parents or from his school. But he really kind of nails that decency that is known to be a feature of that kind of British individual.
Yeah, yeah, I would wholeheartedly agree with that. He just, it seems effortless.
Yeah, yeah, and I wonder if he had better, I'm going to say luck in his career, whether, you know, he would have been allowed to expand his repertoire at all, or, you know, whether he would be stuck playing, you know, I mean, I could see him getting his own detective series in the 80s, to be honest.
I could see that, or
Trevor Eve style, you know.
I could see him, like, guest starring on Yes Minister type thing, where he was also doing a member of the establishment.
Yeah.
Or even doing some of the Smiley stories with Alec Guinness.
He would have been great in Tinker Tailor or Smiley's People. Or yes, exactly. You know, he would have been a great Peter Gwillem. You know, even though it was Michael Jason kind of nailed that, and sad he didn't come back for the second series. But yeah, no, I mean, he would have been awesome in any of those.
Yeah, yeah, he fits that bill so well, and I think it is a shame that, probably mostly health reasons, caused him to start losing work.
Yeah, yeah.
So, because he certainly didn't get typecast with one season of Who playing Harry Sullivan.
No, no. I mean, he's typecast in my brain through one season of Who being Harry Sullivan. But no, I mean, I think as far as I don't know. All I know is that he was incredibly popular with me and my group of friends. We thought he was amazing. We really identified with him. And he was certainly typecast according to us. I think it was very unlikely, or certainly very unlucky, if he had been typecast through one season of Who. But I do think it is interesting that he is a little bit stuck playing these same kind of characters. Certainly on the television. I'm not really going to say he ever really kind of broke into movies, because, you know, he was the same character in two movies.
Just walk-on characters, too, in movies.
Yeah,
too.
I mean, obviously I haven't been able to track down Dr. Faustus yet, but I'm guessing that the Emperor wasn't a very big part in that. Mm. But, I mean, I think he would have had a pretty solid career. I'm so sorry that he never made it to his 40s and 50s and, you know, got older and, you know, maybe slightly more gravitas and less bulldog Drummond kind of puppy dogness about him, and started to maybe have some more kind of grounded characters, which I think he would have played very, very well.
Yeah, yeah, it really is a career cut short, and you can just see the potential in him and as an actor, just looking at some of the other bits of characterizations that he was doing to kind of flesh out Harry Sullivan in Doctor Who, like, for example, like at the beginning of Ark in Space begins with a reference to Harry saying you could make a mint off this having in Trafalgar Square. And then the next story with Santarin experiment, the Doctor directs them to the ruins of Trafalgar Square.
Right.
And Harry commenting that there's no lolly sticks or pigeons about, so it's all nice and tidy.
Right. Right.
And so it puts him as a man in London, too. So there's a bit, through Holmes's script editing, I think, this season, and through Martyr's portrayal of Harry, it really ties these episodes together as a six-parter rather than just two individual stories.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think they do knit together very well indeed. And then if you throw in Revenge of the Cybermen, then you get an excellent package within a season. You know, works extremely well, I think, and worked again, you know, just rewinding to my kid brain, it worked very well for my kid brain as well. I remember being pleased that we were returning to Nerva and excited that we were returning to Nerva at a different point in its time. That seemed to me to be an excellent piece of business that I would not have got from any other TV show.
Yeah, something that they really don't do. I mean, the place that you can think of it is Peladon with Pertwee, and then the four-parter, the Ark with Hartnell. There's not a lot of return visits through time.
Yeah, there's not a lot of simply traveling in time, which, you know, takes you back to you know, the original time traveling story, which is H.G. Wells and the Time Machine, you know, which is thought through is the time machine can literally only travel in time, which mm-hmm. is how the story hangs together. But we get relatively little of that in Doctor Who because, you know, it's a space machine and it needs to get from planet to planet. It can't just be on the same point in Earth, and then you have to move it around manually if you want to go somewhere else. That's that wouldn't make any sense.
That would be a bother.
Yeah, that would. That would quickly exhaust the possibility of storytelling. But, you know, there could have been more of that. Mm-hmm. Could have been more of that, you know.
And touching back on what you were saying about Sarah and actresses being asked to scream and shout and react as if they're afraid, a nice bit of business again from Ian Martyr is his reaction to the Wirren falling out of the cupboard at the end of episode one. Like you said, he's totally responsible for that, but it's not that he's fazed by it. He's just kind of like, there's something falling out of the cupboard, and he doesn't have a hysterical, to use a sexist term, reaction to it. He's not over the top. He's that solid bloke.
Calm.
Again. Yep. Astronaut is what I was thinking.
Yeah, astronaut. Yeah, no, not that there have really been any British, well, I guess there's been one or two British astronauts mm-hmm. by now. But yeah, very, very astronauty mm-hmm. yes. in that way. That's a good way of describing it. And of course, you know, for the character, you know, he's been dropped into a story of which he has not had any kind of preparation for in his life in general.
Right.
So if he opens a cupboard and a giant insect falls out, it's like, yeah, okay, that's maybe what happens on space stations like this. Mm-hmm. I should be startled, but I shouldn't be frightened because maybe it's supposed to be there, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah.
So I thought that's a nicely judged reaction. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really thinking about where the character is.
Yeah. Building on this astronaut theme, he has the Mercury 7 of the American space program, the right stuff.
Yeah.
He just seems perfect in this kind of role. And I think this is what the Tom Doctor really needs, is a male foil that he can kind of pal around and rib a little bit, like in the Ark in Space where Harry makes a good observation and the Doctor says, Harry, you're improving, totally due to my influence, of course. But that type of repertoire that we haven't had since Jamie
right.
with the Doctor. And I think it's a missing element of the story, and it's not something that modern Who has ever recaptured either. It's not the same with, like, Barrowman with Captain Jack. There wasn't that kind of the Doctor, you know, good-naturedly ribbing his male traveling companion. It was more of a rivalry type thing. I think it's much better when you have, like, the Donna Noble or Jamie, you know, pals in space.
Yeah. And I think that was a missed opportunity of the Pertwee era. I mean, you had a lot of potential for that
mm-hmm.
during those 5 years with, you know, the UNIT family. And I think that was the original concept behind the establishing of that family in Pertwee's second series, second season, that there would be, these characters would grow. But, you know, whether this was John or whether this was Barry Letts or, you know, I mean, obviously Pertwee got on so well with Katie Manning that it kind of pushed out any of the male characters from having any involvement. You know, mm-hmm. obviously, you know, kind of fan wisdom has the Doctor actually being, you know, very, very deeply attracted to Joe Grant. but yeah, I mean, I think that's a shame. And I think it's interesting that, you know, the Big Finish have recast and reintroduced a Harry Sullivan character to provide some of that, not comedy, but just kind of good-natured, maybe we're actually having a good time kind of response to difficult situations.
Have you listened to any Harry Sullivan portrayals by Christopher Naylor? Nope.
I haven't, because it's just too much. I'm sorry. I apologize. I'm a bad fan. There's too much of it. I can't take it. No, I haven't. I mean, I'm just aware of it, and I guess my assumption is that that's the kind of stuff that he's doing. Oh, Naylor's a good actor. I mean, I've listened to him, and listened to him do other stuff. So,
anyway, it's an interesting pairing that these characters were so loved that we have Harry Sullivan back with Christopher Naylor, and then also Liz Sladen's daughter,
Sadie Miller,
reprising her mother's character.
Yeah, which is testament to the strength of not only the how much these characters are loved by people like us, and we want them back, kind of thing, but also how strong the characters are. You know, that they can work outside of their original actors. And I know I've read criticism online, about, especially about the Harry recasting. But, you know, Naylor's an excellent actor, and there's no reason why that character shouldn't live in another with another actor. I don't feel, anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this, we are getting to a point where these are characters, not we're not typecasting the character to the actor, I guess.
Yeah.
So I think it might be worth our while, once we wrap up Ian Martyr's time with Harry Sullivan, to maybe
dip in,
choose one of the stories and see.
Yeah, we could sort of pull one out of a hat, because I'm not buying them all.
No, our listener could let us know which one is the best, and we can always.
Thank you. If our listener could do that, we would be very, very grateful. Thank you, listener. I'm going to thank you in advance for doing that for us.
So we'll do that after we tackle the novels.
I still haven't sat down and read Splash yet. I might take that. Listener, I'm just about to go away on holiday, so I might take Splash with me and read it on the beach, hoping that a grim and gritty Daryl Hannah will emerge, grim and gritty with lots of blood,
grim
and
gritty
and
Daryl Hannah
stuff coming out of her nostrils. Sorry, I'm just thinking about it. I don't know how Ian Martyr wrote that book. I'm going to assume he didn't write it in the similar way that he wrote his Doctor Who novels, but maybe he did.
Yeah. Well, I guess we'll have to wait for the book report to see.
Damn. Book report. Yes. I haven't. Not only have I not written the report, I haven't read the book yet.
Hmm. He wrote those two stories back to back, too. The Santarin Experiment and the Ark in Space. So both are his penned novelizations.
Well, which is, you know, I mean, and again, it's a shame in some ways. I think they certainly would do this nowadays, that he wasn't allowed to write them in the first person.
Mm.
I mean, I'm assuming he wasn't allowed to write them in the first person, and that wasn't his choice. But, you know, I think the success recently of that Jamie, you know, the
Evil of Daleks.
Evil of Daleks is kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. That, you know, it's written from the perspective of the companion who's writing it, the actor who portrayed that companion, yeah.
I think with Harry's being split up from Sarah and the Doctor so much in the Santarin experiment, that narrative choice may have proved to be difficult.
That is true. You are correct in that. Yes, I agree.
Probably would have worked better with the Ark in Space, though, because yeah. He's, like I said, right in the mix of everything.
He's right in the middle of the action. Yeah, though it would be fun to kind of, you know, get him to write Genesis of the Daleks or something, only from the perspective of Harry Sullivan. Ah, it's a clam.
Why am I always putting my foot into it?
Exactly. Always putting my foot into the clam, so to speak.
Yeah, we don't get much of the, I guess, falling into a pit, covered pit. Is that hairy clumsiness on display? Or with the Doctor having the same accident, I don't know if we can fault Harry so much for that.
Well, I mean, as Sarah so ably points out, it was concealed. Mm-hmm. So how is he supposed to know it's there? I mean, you know, the concealed pit is kind of a movie, TV, adventure serial trope. Mm-hmm. I've never actually seen a pit that I wasn't able to notice, even though it was concealed. But, you know, he's not. Well, I'm going to say about Harry Sullivan, he's no Kevin Lindsay when it comes to stepping around Dartmoor.
It's not that light on his feet.
Exactly. Exactly. Needs to take some lessons from the master.
Right. Well, any other final thoughts on Ark in Space, Santarin Experiment?
Those are my thoughts. They are a very pleasurable rewatch, as always. Pretty much faultless for me. And there's always new things to find out and enjoy. And actually, in some ways, it's fun to watch them paying attention to one of the actors. Mm-hmm. Because, again, you pick up nuances and things that are happening that, you know, you may not do if you were just kind of enjoying the story as a story rather than watching for an actor.
Yeah, I found a nice focus on Harry, which wouldn't have been the primary reason to watch any of these, I think. And it's a nice way of seeing the story from what his character was able to do or not do in each.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I agree. Yeah.
So, I mean, actually, you know, if you would like a recommendation, try that with a Who episode, a favorite one, and just watch it for one actor only. It's actually kind of a lot of fun.
Indeed, yeah. Right. Well, thank you for listening to episode 256 of the Metabulous 2 podcast. I have been searching for the appropriate cravat with Ben.
And I have been waving a big stick around on Dartmoor with David.
Until next time.
Farewell.
ever feel frustrated that Harry wasn't getting enough to do? Constantly is the answer to that. Yes, it's really a bit of a... The reason, really, I think, is that my character, the character of Harry, was brought in at a time when the Doctor wasn't... The new Doctor wasn't completely decided upon. And I think they felt they needed to have somebody around to sort of leak through glass panes and out of high windows and run up and down cliffs and things, just in case whoever they got was perhaps one of the more elderly, shall we say, of the acting fraternity who might not be able to do it. When, of course, Tom was finally cast and everything, that immediately became superfluous. But by then I was, in, shall we say, contractually involved, and they had to find things for me to do, which they sometimes managed to do and quite a lot of the time didn't. So in a way, that's the reason that I think Harry was quite spare in both senses of the word. Quite a lot of the time. I think that actually I would have preferred to have been a bit more active and perhaps a bit more sensible, although it's quite fun playing a sort of, what's the word for naff?
Am I as clumsy as my character? It depends very much where I am and who I'm with.